The Guardian.
I wanted to touch on some of the things that we talked about in our other conversations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We did that interview for Black Book a couple of weeks ago, and you closed out the interview with like the most incredible statement. We were talking about the issue of environment and future, and you said, we can change it. I'm not saying things are going to get fixed right away, but I think we're in the process of learning how to make technology communicate with nature, feminine communicate with masculine, the spiritual unite with the scientific. These two sides have been separated for 200 years, and they can be combined again. And I honestly don't know anyone else that's putting forward an idea like that right now, you know. I mean, I guess because I've been so immersed in research and trying to like follow what climate scientists are projecting for our future, and it seems like you're projecting a different kind of a possibility that's maybe partly informed by the science that's available to us now, but also informed by a kind of an inspiration or a sense of inspiration.
I guess I just feel on many levels that this is happening. For example, with medication and doctors, we sort of used to having like for 200 or 300 years, like this separation between like Western medicine and alternative medicine or whatever. And it seems like the two worlds are uniting. And I think it's like on many levels. And the more history you read, it seems like that this split between those two worlds, you know, seem to have happened, you know, a few hundred years ago, but it hasn't, majority of the time of human history, the split hasn't been there. I guess it's quite inspiring always to read sort of what happened in human history, say, before 1500s, where, for example, the spiritual and the scientific is the same thing. In some ways, I feel that the difference between mythology and science is just a question of if it's past or if it hasn't happened yet. Already, scientists are talking about now that the Big Bang was like a theory of the 20th century. It's already kind of going a little bit out of date. I mean, that doesn't mean it's untrue. I think that's very much, you know, the mythology of the 20th century. You have Albert Einstein and you have the nuclear bomb and you have, you know, certain aesthetic, both in arts and in music and architecture and everywhere. It's kind of built around this kind of very specific creation myth that Western civilization had then, which called the Big Bang, you know. And I'm sure in 500 years people will look back on the Big Bang and in a similar way as, for example, the creation myth of the Vikings. But, I mean, I think that system that was sort of reached its peak in the 50s, it's already fading, and there's we're sort of heading into a new era now, I think.
I love the idea of talking about the Big Bang as a creation myth. It's so fantastic to, like, recontextualize it like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to come across as that I know it all, or I'm like some prophet.
No, but the reason that, for me, I found it really inspiring, because it is in such contrast to so much of the information that's out there right now. You know what I mean? For me, I spend so much of my time reading, like, the IPCC reports and reading, like the Stephen Hawking interview recently in The Guardian, where he's saying that, you know, the future of humanity lies in the colonization of other planets because we've almost finished the resources of this planet. Even like the great, you know, scientific minds that we look to for their inspiration and clarity, are so many of them are indicating that we've entered into like a really virulent phase. And there's not many people swimming against the tide of that and suggesting that we're going to find a new kind of balance.
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, I was just asked to do a quote about Alexander McQueen couple of days ago, and I think the problem is a lot the sort of the psyche of the US and UK. It's like empires that are in a decay right now, and they don't realize that all its inhabitants are sort of have this feeling. I feel a lot of them feel like they're on the sinking ship, and that's it, you know. And people make such bad decisions when their ship is sinking, you know. The people that come from the UK and the US are actually a minority of the planet. You know, they're not that many. They're like, I don't know, 400 million or something. And the rest is, I don't know, 5.6 billion or something. And a lot of other countries are actually on the up. They haven't even started, you know. And then the US and the UK, they kind of have the power of most of the media in the world. And they kind of like control how humanity looks on themselves and how they feel about themselves. And for an Icelander like me and a lot of the immigrants I was hanging out with in London, we used to obviously, you know, chat and get drunk or whatever, and he used to talk about how boring it was, this apocalyptic view, and it's just so self-important of Western civilization to feel that the rest of the world should enjoy and feel this decay with them. If you're not convinced we're all going down the drain, you're insensitive or you're, I don't know what, you know? And I think all the empires have gone up and come down, you know, and it's a natural thing, you know, and the English Empire maybe had its peak maybe 100 years ago or whatever, and the US maybe like 50 years ago, and they're still the most powerful one, but the fertility and the growth is, you know, is in a different place now. And but I mean, I think where we're heading now is maybe to a more global environment where it's actually not about nations anyway. That's a place where we all belong, and in this place, there's a lot of discoveries being made in science, and we are forced, if we like it or not, to, you know, learn about nature, recycle, and use the sources we have. And this idea, just because the oil is finished and everything's, all the energy is finished, is ridiculous, you know. And I mean, I remember reading a science fiction book the other day describing when some aliens were flying towards the planet, and it just seems odd that on a planet with so much light and sun, for example, compared to all other planets in the universe, that they are obsessed with this one thing in the earth called oil, you know, that's right, very little off and will only last like 100, 150 years or something. I mean, but it was the same thing with the coal. When you know, London was covered with coal smog, and everybody was like, oh, my, you know, everybody had TB or whatever and were coughing and, do you know what I mean? And everybody's like, oh, we're all going to die and it's all going downhill. And I mean, there's always been this voice of, I mean, look in the Bible, you know, with Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, this kind of end of the world talk. And I mean, I think it's, and then people get over it. I mean, I think there's just as much chance that we're all going to die as we are all going to go up and everything's going to be amazing. I think probably it's somewhere in the middle. But I think also this pessimism, it can be quite romantic, and it can be quite sort of, it's quite self-indulgent in a way, and it's quite addictive too, you know, this, especially as an aesthetic.
So I mean, on one hand, I can appreciate, like, dismantling, like, romantic, indulgent view of the future as doomed. But on the other hand, I mean, do you notice a change in the weather from when you were a kid?
Yeah, I do, actually. And we're not getting snow in the winter, really, here now. It's warmer here now, and there's not as much snow. It's a change.
How do you reason with that? This, if you do perceive a change in the environment, what's our responsibility to that within the course of our lives?
I mean, I can only speak for the situation in Iceland, and I think it's important to be proactive, you know, and I think it makes a difference. I still feel, I mean, I probably always will, you know, totally different walking up and down my street here in Iceland or go to a city. I mean, for me, the contrast between, say, Iceland and New York is like major, you know, and I can trust my instincts in Iceland, but in New York, I can't. You know, I can run on Icelandic fuel in New York for about 2 weeks, and then I run out of it, and I get very, like a animal in a cage, you know? And things that make me feel good are things like oxygen, and I'm sure they haven't invented the machines yet, but to measure it, but something about physics, like the physical pressure of the skyscrapers and the especially the energy you get from the ground up, like up your legs, you know, when you're having walks outside in Iceland. Like, I don't feel that at all, you know. And the only way for me to energize in New York is to, like, just drink cappuccinos, and it feels really artificial. So, I mean, that's my personal experience. I mean, if you're asking me to tune into my instincts, you know, and how I feel, I mean, I feel Iceland still has this connection with the energy of the universe, you know, and doesn't think of itself as separate unity that can survive without it. And but it could very easily, very quickly, like if we don't act now, it could become like the rest of Europe, you know. So it is on a very interesting crossroads. So I feel what I've got to say to an answer like this is obviously very colored from where I come from, and very colored with what options I see here in Iceland that are, like, doable, you know. And I can look out my window right now, and I you know, I see the ocean, and I see the wind and the trees, and it's real, you know. It's not utopian, you know. It's a relationship most Icelanders have with nature. It's very real. It's our everyday life, you know. So, I mean, I have a big belief in, for example, like computers. And when I see something like an iPod and how easy it is for everybody to operate, you know, it's very easy for me to imagine solar-powered houses and you know, like something that just anybody could do. It's not some crazy hippie in Phoenix, Arizona, you know. I mean, it seems to me, like, from what I've read, I mean, I haven't read a lot, but it's easier to apply this kind of green model on cities that are more 19th century, like Havana or like Istanbul or Malta, that have more space between houses and are more like neighborhoods and not so much built straight up, you know?
Right.
But to be honest, I feel a bit like I'm on slippery slope here, because I'm not really an expert, you know?
Right, yeah. I wanted to ask a question as a live performer. When you're on stage, from where do you draw your energy? How is that mapped out for you?
I mean, it probably is different every night in a certain way, of course, because at least half of it is stuff that you can't control. And that's the charm of performing live, right? Because you are just in that particular mood that day, and you're tired or you're energetic, and things have happened, say, in the group that is touring, like somebody has lost a father, or somebody had a baby, or things like that, obviously affect a lot. And sort of where you are with the musicians, like if you're in the beginning of a tour or end of a tour, or is this material you're exhausted with, or is it really fresh, you know, or is it in the middle, you know, like, I mean, I would say things like that are like out of your control, you know, or what do you call it, changeable. It's not in your power to, like, control them, and that's something you obviously don't rely on as a energy source or whatever. I mean, I guess personally, I walk around a lot in Iceland. That's how I learned to sing. So that's just sort of my idea of home is me walking around singing outside somewhere. So I guess that's quite a introvert affair for me personally a lot of the time. So when I sing, I, without being conscious or totally conscious of it, I'm probably tapping into this space, you know, where basically a lot of it is celebration of space and celebration of oxygen, you know, and it's the fact that you walk outside and you have a lot of space all around you. There's no people, there's no plants, and there's no animals, you know? So you just have landscapes, you know, like shapes of mountains, but sort of without the fluffy stuff, you know? So yeah. If there's a mantra for it, it would be, I have a lot of space.
I love the idea of celebration of oxygen. I guess my last question kind of bounces off of a conversation that we had a couple of times from different angles just on our walks around. Do you have any inclinations as to what you might be in dialogue with beyond the course of this life?
Well, it's a big question. I always felt when I die, I'll just become part of the planets again somehow. You know, like I can imagine myself more like becoming like Earth and part of a planet. And then I really like ideas in science when you see that planets, they explode, and then they, all the stuff that's they're made of, they, it comes like material for new planets, so everything is used again, you know. So I guess I find stuff like that more of a turn on. I would love to be part of the Milky Way than the sort of karma idea. I find that, I mean, it's hard for me to relate to it, you know?
Yeah.
Sorry, it's a really big question. I'm not sure if I answered that very well.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.